kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have so much information. This is going to be one empowering hour. We're going to tell you the latest on how to fight cancer by eating one vegetable. Information from Dr. Joseph Marcola. And something that most people simply never eat, probably never in their life. Also, there are 70,000 food additives approved by the FDA. What you don't know will hurt you, and we'll explore that. Cannabis oil cures an 8-month-old infant dissolving large tumor in 8 months. And high blood sugar raises depression risk in diabetes. We have lots on health and nutrition. Then we have a lot on the environment today, shorter segments, but about 10 different issues, including the study that the Earth is heading for mass extinction event. This is from Kelly Bergen. This is a landmark study by an international group of scientists have concluded that planet Earth is on the brink of a mass extinction event comparable in scale to the one that wiped out dinosaurs 65 million years ago. The researchers found that extinction rates are currently 1,000 times higher than normal due to deforestation, climate change, and the depletion of ocean fisheries. From Duke University, we'll talk about that. Then new tests find that bee-killing pesticide is in 51% of the bee-friendly plants from garden centers across the United States. Also, weak regulations turned a West Virginia person's community into an involuntary guinea pig community. Gary Zukot on that. University of Southern California, scientists create a new battery. This is good news. That's cheap, clean, rechargeable, and organic. How long does it last? 15 years with 5,000 recharge cycles. And it's a big battery for big operations. That's really good. And also, with heat and humidity, areas will be, quote, unsuitable for outdoor activity. Wonder where? Surely Miami, yeah, Miami. But how about New York, Chicago, and Seattle also? Atlanta and Washington also? Well, quote, as temperatures rise towards the end, less than an hour of activity outdoors in the shade could cause a moderately fit individual to suffer heat stroke. That's something that doesn't exist today, but it will, and they're going to get to that. Are we fishing every fish to extinction? Yes. Tel Aviv University gives us latest on that. And, well, that's enough on that. Then we're going to deal with the public health science on vaccine researcher charged with felony crimes for research fraud. What'd he do? Mike Adams, Natural News, gives you a look behind the scene of what really goes on. And then a global report on neonicotinoid disaster, a wake-up call to save the bees. And pesticides threaten birds and bees alike. Then from our other elements, we will have Barbara Lou Fisher on as our guest today, talking about if a kid gets vaccinated, shouldn't they be protected from an unvaccinated kid or from the condition? Well, you'd think not so. Quote, almost 20% of fully vaccinated children with persistent cough have whooping cough. But hold on. They were vaccinated for whooping cough. Yes. Well, then it didn't work. Wasn't effective. Then this is just one big scam. Barbara Lou Fisher, who is the president of the National Vaccine Information Center, will give us her insights. Then from an in-depth commentary today, from Dr. Henry Giroux, Truth Out, Data Storms and the Theory of Manufactured Forgetting. A new recession is here. I'll tell you about that. And here's something you have not probably heard. TISA, T-I-S-A, Trade and Services Agreement. It's just the latest Obama betrayal in favor of the big banks. It's bad to the bone. and you should know about it. Let's begin. As you see, we're just packed with information. And for those of you who are listening around the country, and we have people all over the world listening, but if you listen in North America and Canada, if there's ever a problem, you can call a number and hear the program. 401, write this down, please. 401-347-0456. 401-347-0456. But because we have so many people listening over the telephone, we're number one out of 4,500 radio stations. People listening off the phone, we have a backup number. 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231. Boost your antioxidant levels and fight cancer by eating bok choy. Bok, B-O-K, choy, C-H-O-Y. Here is what Dr. Joseph Marcola has to say. Quote, bok choy is the most popular vegetable in China, where it's been cultivated for 5,000 years. This member of the cruciferous family is a type of cabbage that has a mild flavor, making it useful for stir-fry, soup, side dishes, and even eating raw. But because bok choy's impressive nutritional profile has it up at the highest end of nutrient input, bok choy, which is also referred to as Chinese white cabbage, contains vitamin C and K, plus a higher concentration of beta-carotene and vitamin A than any other variety of cabbage. It also contains important nutrients such as calcium, magnesium, potassium, manganese, all wrapped up in low calories. And one cup of bok choy contains only 20 calories. It's high in fiber. And it also will boost your overall antioxidant levels. Bok choy also has lots of vitamin A, phytonutrients, thiocyanates, lutein, isothiocyanates, and sulforaphane, all of which stimulate detoxifying enzymes and may protect against breast, colon, and prostate cancers. Indole-3-carbinol, or I3C, another antioxidant phytocompound in bok choy, halts the cell cycle in breast cancer cells without actually killing the cells, which might help explain why Chinese breast cancer survivors who ate the most cruciferous vegetables had a 62% lower risk of death. 62% lower risk of breast cancer death, and then 35% lower risk of breast cancer reoccurrence than those who ate the least. Remember, in China, bok choy is the number one vegetable, or in the United States, it's zero. And sulforaphane also targets cancer stem cells, and by doing so, it effectively prevents the cancer from spreading and reoccurring. It's also anti-inflammatory. It turns off inflammation throughout the entire body. And there's a type of polyphenol called anthocyanins and thiocyanate, and these protect cells from inflammatory substances in the body. It's also better bone health than via vitamin K. One cup of bok choy contains 26% of the recommended daily allowance of vitamin K1. It's excellent as a source of calcium, and it regulates your immune system. So those are some good reasons to bring a new vegetable. It's very inexpensive, by the way. And because it doesn't have a strong flavor, you can steam it and put it in brown rice. You can put it into a soup. You can make a slaw out of it and add in some radish. I like to make my own fresh slaw, and I'll use kale in the slaw, red cabbage, bok choy. So once you grate it, which takes you a minute, you wash and grate it, then I take some organic low-sodium pickles, and I'll grate a pickle in there too. I'll take a teaspoon of mustard, stone-ground organic mustard, put it in, tablespoon of coconut oil, tablespoon of olive oil, some little Himalayan sea salt, black pepper and cayenne pepper, and then anise and anise and fennel, a little bit, and then you stir it all around, and then that is a delicious tasting slaw. People will love that because he won't be able to figure out the taste because there's so many competing tastes that every bite reawakens the taste buds. So try that. Let's have some simple ways to unclog our arteries, because as a nation, our arteries are really damaged. The endothelial lining has been damaged from eating the foods that we eat, the hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, meat, sandwiches, processed foods. You can reverse that. There's no reason you can't clean up your arteries, and that helps you live a longer life. From Sayer G, Green Man Info, how do you do it? Now, this is all from peer-reviewed published research, the B-complex. B-complex, according to the journal Atherosclerosis, and not high milligrams, like 25 milligrams of B6, about 500 micrograms B12, 2.5 milligrams of folic acid for 1 year, did exactly that. Significant reduction in arterial thickness, and that's a measure by intima media thickness. Even using niacin is good as well. And then pomegranate. Now, pomegranate's great to grow, very hardy. And then, of course, you open it up, take out the little orbs, the little seeds, and that's what gives you your nutrition. They last about 10 days if you refrigerate them. They last indefinitely if you freeze them. So the pomegranate can help regress plaque buildup in the arteries. Then fermented cabbage. Now, I can't stand the taste of kimchi. A lot of people love this South Korean dish. It's a fermented cabbage with hot peppers. But they also include fermented fish, and boy, that's got to be the rankest smell in the world. By the way, the Italians back in Pompeii loved fermented fish. In effect, that's fish that's rotted. So I'll pass on that, because just regular good old sauerkraut, that's much better. Now, if you want to add something to sauerkraut to give it a little extra zeal, you can. What I like to do is take a Comus pear, or you can take a apple pear. You dice them, blend it in with some dried mulberries into your sauerkraut. That's an exciting way to make a dish pop. So fermented cabbage can help loosen up your arteries, and it also degrades toxic chemicals and helps chelate out toxins. L-arginine, now this is an amino acid, and it prevents arterial thickening by up to 24%, and that's good. Turmeric, more specifically the curcumin in turmeric, and that's a primary polyphenol in the Indian spice turmeric. And there are at least 30 different studies showing that turmeric can help prevent damage to your arteries. And then sesame seeds. Now, black sesame seeds are particularly good, and raw, organic tahini made from sesame seeds is probably the most effective, because they're going to be already digested. So when you're eating the sesame paste, and you can make your own halva, I like to make it with manuka honey, and I use allspice, cinnamon, a little nutmeg, vanilla extract. I blend that with the raw organic sesame, and then I refrigerate it. And then you put that on to a dish and let someone sample it. And it's a different way of experiencing halva. But sesame seeds are terrifically beneficial. So, in fact, it was shown to be sesame seed was as effective as Tylenol for arthritis pain. So those are the ones that matter. This week I did a lecture. I should say last week I did a lecture. And I was talking about the extremes in our society, what I call the extreme of duality, and how once we buy in to this myth of duality, then we actually strengthen it. We refortify the myth that life will be better if I have all of the gadgets and tools and toys and people that are supposed to make me happy. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Just witness all the people in our world who have everything that you could ever imagine, and yet they're unhappy people and always wanting more. And we have learned better lessons from people throughout our history. And what I said was, all you have to do is go to a place like India, and there you'll see extremes. you'll see 800 million people who do not have running water. They don't have any of the accommodations of a normal, healthy life. And as a result, they're victims of the environment and the corrupt politics and the racism of that community. And I just gave one example. There are 5 million baby girls killed each year in India because of the poor people believing they don't want a little girl, they want a little boy, and how badly the girls are treated. And we see this. It's a great injustice. Gandhi saw it. He fought against it. But on the other end of that, and you also have extreme wealth. If you have the money, you can buy yourself environments outside of the major cities and the old Rajas' palaces. You can have beautiful places built where you're not surrounded by ghettos, and fly there in a helicopter. And millions of people have that kind of wealth. In fact, India is unique in that it has the largest number of wealthy people and upper-middle-class people and professional-class people in the world of any country. And then it has the largest uneducated poor class, and it goes by extremes. Those who have want for nothing. Those who have not want for everything. Just imagine if you had to bathe because you were engaged in a ritual bath each day in water like the Ganges, which is one of the most polluted bodies of water in the world, where unfiltered sewage, human excrement, dead bodies just flow through the water. And you have to wash your clothes in that. You have to get water from that. And yet, that should be a major priority, but it isn't. The priority for people in power is always to accumulate more of it. Promise the people you're going to change their circumstances, but then you don't have to. Because rarely do people follow up on what you promise. They're more interested in your efforts at the beginning, not your results later on. And you just can't imagine how the duality of people choosing to all live in the same environment or forced to do business, and yet how they segregate themselves out, where you go through the worst smells and dirt and grime and everything broken down and congestion to get to a beautiful office or a campus where high-tech people work. It's unique in this, the extremes of this duality. But there was one person who told us this shouldn't happen. Here's what he said. These are negative human virtues. Wealth without work. Pleasure without conscience. Knowledge without character. Business without ethics. Science without humanity. Religion without sacrifice. Politics without principle. Who said that? If you know who said those statements, call 888-874-4888. I'd like to see if you're in touch with that kind of ethic. In any case, we can change everything if we understand context, not just information out of context. So in India, many of the poorest people have been able to live long lives because they knew how to counteract many of the negatives in their environment. That's one of the reasons you have spices and really hot spices in a lot of foods, because people were dying of food poisoning or poisoned from people's hands, E. coli. And the hotter the spice, the more likely it is to kill off elements inside, bacteria, viruses. And hence, that's one of the reasons that India has a history of using very spicy food. Smart to do that. Now, this is from PreventDisease.com, from Marco Torres. According to Dr. William Courtney, the Western medical mind has a very hard time, if not impossible time, trying to understand the diverse actions of a cannabis oil. He explained how his young patient, who was only 8 months old, had a very massive, centrally located, inoperable brain tumor. The child's father pushed for non-traditional treatment utilizing cannabis and put the oil in the baby's pacifier twice a day, gradually increasing the dose. Within 2 months, there was a dramatic reduction. Dr. Courtney pointed out that the success of the cannabis approach means that, quote, this child is not going to have the long-term side effects that would have come from a very high dose of chemotherapy radiation. So more research should definitely be done, because all it takes is one case to open up the idea that there's something working that we weren't aware of. And finally, 70,000 food additives are approved by the FDA. What you don't know could hurt you, from Natural News. And a lot of these are genetically modified. And they're all on the generally recognized as safe list of cosmetic and personal care products. There's virtually no regulations on chemicals on your skin, and your skin can absorb these chemicals, get into your bloodstream. And so they're suggesting, and I agree with them, that sodium benzoate, BHA, BHT, remove them. And look at the toxic list. Here are some of the toxic lists that can affect adrenal glands of hogs, cattle, and sheep. It's common in medicine. Adrenaline, that's where it comes from. What if it's genetically engineered hog or cattle? Do you want that in your body? Albumin, made from blood, eggs, cow's milk, often used to add texture to a thickening food like baked goods, cakes, cookies, pastries, candies, and cosmetics. They're also in vaccines. And you have carmine, which is from insects, female beetles. Clarifying agent, animal-based, egg, gelatin, fish bladder, used to make liquids clear. Dextrose, which is genetically modified corn sugar. And diglycerides, made from cow and hogs. They're used in baked goods, peanut butter, chewing gum, whipped toppings, sweets, drinks, ice creams, and shortenings. Dough conditioner, the glycerol monosterate, and potassium bromate, and monocalcium sulfate. You don't want this stuff. Emulsifiers made from cows, hogs, eggs, milk? No. Nope, monosodium glutamate. You've got all these chemicals. The FDA says they're not harmful, and you'd ask the FDA, could you show us where you've done an actual study on humans in combination to see if these things actually are harmful? They don't have any such studies. And that's the fact. Now let's go to our environmental segment. We have a lot of issues here, and I'll just run through them. First off, we know for some time, in fact, I reported on this program 4 years ago, that the neonicotinoids were causing the bee colony collapse, one of the principal causes. This is the latest from Common Dreams. Quote, neonicotinoids threaten the heart of a functioning ecosystem. A widely used class of insecticides poses a threat on a par to that of DDT and is harming ecosystems worldwide. This damning analysis, based upon 800 different peer-reviewed reports, entitled The Worldwide Integrated Assessment of the Impact of Systemic Pesticides on Biodiversity and Ecosystems, puts a spotlight on neonicotinoids, or neonics, whose use, they say, poses a threat to global biodiversity. In addition to, quote, the clear and complete evidence that neonicotinoids pose threats to bees and other pollinators, a point many environmental groups have stressed, the analysis found that the most effective group was terrestrial invertebrates like earthworms, which are exposed to varying levels of the systemic pesticides through multiple pathways, like the soil that plants itself in water. The toxic reach of these neonicotinoids goes beyond the farmland, the study finds, as the soil absorbs the pesticide, dust from the fields where treated seeds were drilled can blow into neighboring areas, and polluted groundwater can reach downstream and affect other ecosystems. Now here's what's important. You have, quote, the evidence is very clear, says Dr. Jean-Marc Bonmatin of the National Center for Scientific Research in France, one of the lead authors. Quote, we are witnessing a threat to the productivity of our national, natural, and farmed environment equivalent to that posed by organic phosphates or DDT. Far from protecting food production, the use of neonicotinoids is threatening the very infrastructure which enables it, imperiling the polluters, habitat engineers, and natural pest controls at the heart of the functioning ecosystem. So here's the president who comes up with a way to try to appease his core base, saying, we're concerned about the decimation of bees, so we're going to look into this. Okay, that gets him off the hook and out of office before the report is issued. And yet here is the report from 800 different peer-reviewed scientific papers, the most comprehensive report in the world, and yet not a word that it already exists, because then they would have to look at the worldwide integrated assessment of the impact of systemic pesticides on biodiversity and ecosystems and say, wow, it's already there. We have the answer. It's all politics, and it's all rotten to the core all the time in the cesspool called Washington, D.C. I just wish there was a way to flush the toilet and let all that crap in Washington from the Supreme Court justices. And the whole damn city, in my opinion, is just nothing but a cesspool. It just stinks. But somehow we tolerate it, and we shouldn't. One more from Terra Daily. Pesticides threaten birds and bees alike. Quote, neurotoxic pesticides blamed for the world's bee collapse are also harming butterflies, worms, fish, and birds. And that's in a new report on this as well. Then, this I found interesting. This is from Kelly Bergman. Quote, a landmark study by an international group of scientists has concluded that planet Earth is on the brink of a mass extinction event comparable in scale to the one that wiped out the dinosaur 65 million years ago. And this is from a Duke University biologist, Stuart Pym. Quote, time is running out to avert the threat of mass extinction. And then it goes on to talk about the depleted fisheries, driving species to extinction. They killed 20,000 elephants last year. If this continues, elephants and tigers will be extinct in 5 years. Yet, it's not on the news. And also, when you go to your garden center to get some bee-friendly plants, be careful, because 51% of those bee-friendly plants from garden centers are bee-killing pesticide-laden. Quote, many bee-friendly home garden plants sold at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart have been pre-treated with pesticides shown to harm and kill bees. That's according to a study from Friends of the Earth. The study Gardeners Beware 2014 shows 36 out of 71, or 51% of garden plant samples purchased at top garden retailers in 18 cities in the United States and Canada contain neonicotinoid pesticides, a key contributor to recent bee declines. Some of the flowers contain neonic levels high enough to kill bees outright, assuming comparable concentrations are present in the flowers' pollen and nectar. Further, 40% of the positive samples contain two or more nicotinoids. So, buy your plants from smaller venues that do not use pesticides. Weak regulations turn my West Virginia community into involuntary guinea pigs in an enormous scientific experiment. From Gary Zukat, from Other Word, quote, like most Americans, I always took the clean water running out of my tap for granted. That changed in January when West Virginia's American Water sent out an all-points alert to stop drinking, cooking, washing, or doing anything else with the water flowing into my home, except flush the toilet. Thus began the biggest fouling of a public water supply in our nation's history. Thanks to the negligence of the Freedom Industries, a supplier of chemicals to the coal industry, all schools, restaurants, hotels, and other public facilities in our 9-county region closed immediately. State lawmakers, who had just started the legislative session in Charleston, were sent home from the capital city. Many businesses didn't open their doors again for a full week, and then had to post "We use bottled water" signs in their windows to lure the customers back. Everyone in my community had become water refugees. 6 months later, here in Charleston, we're still dealing with the spill's aftermath. We've come to realize that clean water is a precious commodity. This is more than a problem affecting 1 in 6 West Virginian residents. It's a national health issue that could harm any of our 54,000 public water supply systems. A recent National Geographic article catalogs various ways our public water sources are threatened, the perils including coash from utilities, farm feedlot waste lagoons, oil pipelines, and motor and rail transportation oil and chemicals. By the way, I'd add in there hydrofracking. The other national issue this disaster underlines is the legacy of the Toxic Substance Control Act. When Congress passed the law in 1976 to regulate chemicals, the government grandfathered 62,000 chemicals already in use at the time, exempting them from regulations imposed on new potential toxins. According to Physicians for Social Responsibility, less than 200 of these chemicals have been tested for human safety. The government has only banned 5 chemicals in 24 years. The chemical that ended up providing the licorice smell coming out of my showerhead, called MCHM, is on the list of 62,000 exempted and untested. No one has a clue what long-term effects my family and the rest of us exposed before, during, and after the crisis will face. Thanks to these weak regulations, we've turned into involuntary guinea pigs in an enormous science experiment. You bet, and it's only going to get worse, until such time that we actually demand that our water be held in common, that we do not allow people to be able to privatize it like Nestle and Coca-Cola and others for their use, or gas hydrofrackers, when we put strict standards on the quality of water that comes out of the ground and quality of water goes back into the ground, and no one should be deprived of water because a commercial use supersedes them. That would be a humane way of dealing with this. And by the way, it was a year ago that I did a program on Detroit, a city of extremes. And I said that it's going to be exploited to the extreme now by vulture capitalists. Mark my words, I said, that the day's going to come when they're going to privatize the water to squeeze the poorest of the poor out of their last remaining dollars. Now, last week, they turned off the water to 151,000 residents of Detroit because they hadn't paid their water bill. That should never happen. Good news, the University of Southern California has developed a water-based organic battery that is long-lasting, built from cheap, eco-friendly compounds. And the new battery, which uses no metals or no toxic materials, is intended for use in power plants, where it can make the energy grid more resilient and efficient by creating a large-scale means to store energy for use as needed. Quote, the batteries last for 5,000 recharge cycles, giving them an estimated 15-year lifespan. That was from professor of chemistry at the University of Southern California and Dr. Narayan, author of the paper on these, and it was published in the Journal of Electrochemical Society. Quote, lithium-ion batteries degrade after around 1,000 cycles and cost 10 times more to manufacture. Such organic flow batteries will be game changers for grid electrical energy storage in terms of simplicity, cost, reliability, and sustainability. That's good news. So I'm going to share that with you. And for those of you who've noticed how difficult it is to just enjoy yourself sometimes because it's so hot, but it's also humid, this is from Sharon Begley from Reuters. With heat and humidity, areas will be, quote, unsuited for outdoor activity. The old adage, it's not the heat, it's the humidity, will come into play more often and in more places because of climate change, with life-altering results in southern U.S. cities from Miami to Atlanta to Washington, even northern cities such as New York, Chicago, and Seattle. Yep, we're already there. I mean, many cities right now are experiencing record temperatures. Quote, the body's capacity to cool down in hot weather depends upon evaporation of sweat that keeps skin temperature below 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees Celsius. Above that, core temperature rise past 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. But if humidity is also high, sweat cannot evaporate, and core temperature can increase until the person collapses from heat stroke. Quote, if it's humid, you can't sweat. And if you can't sweat, you can't maintain core body temperature in the heat, and you die. End quote, Dr. Al Summer, Dean Emeritus of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, and the author on this. Just in the strangest race I ever did, well, the hardest race was the Jamaica Marathon. And We thought it had been well planned. It wasn't. We ran out of water after 3 miles, and they decided to got started very late, and it was in the summer, and it was boiling. And then right in the middle, they had this huge hill. And there's a photograph of myself and Sam Skinner. We were teammates, and we both raced. We both won gold medals. And I have white all over my skin. That's my body's minerals and sodium. That's how dehydrated it was. Several times I thought I was going to have a heat stroke. But you can see the picture up there. And I think that was the last time they were allowed to do a marathon. It was so bad. In any case, I did the World Games in Puerto Rico. And they did it in the middle of August. And it was so hot that in the 20K, where we would have won the gold, but one of the three of us, this guy, he couldn't make it in the final stretch. And the other two teams, one team passed, so we took the silver. But they had all these swimming pools, little kids' pools, you know, like 8 foot across, foot and a half deep, filled with ice. And all these men were just falling into the, not even finishing. We're talking about you do 12 miles in a race and you can't make the final stretch. They were just collapsing into this because they were sweating. It was so humid. And once again, they couldn't cool. And then they would just dehydrate and you'd see them wobbling. And then, boom, down they go. And so they drag them into this ice water to cool them down. I've never seen anything. There must have been 100 of these in the last quarter mile of the straight stretch. I've never seen that before. Finally, are fish near extinction? From Tel Aviv University. Tel Aviv University researchers discover the biological flaw that dooms fish larvae's ability to feed. Quote, fish are disappearing. The sensational media headlines were the result of a 2010 report by the United Nations Environmental Program declaring that overfishing and pollution had nearly emptied the ocean's fish stocks. Here's what they found in a new study by the Department of Zoology at Tel Aviv University's George Weiss Facility for Life Sciences. They uncovered the reason why 90% of fish larvae are biologically doomed to die mere days after hatching. Quote, we can find a solution to the looming crisis in the world, but they're dying off. And the reason why is that what is called hydrodynamic starvation. Now, what's hydrodynamic starvation? What that means is the physical inability to feed due to environmental incompatibility. That's the reason. So when you make the water too acidic, when the water is too hot, you change the entire biodynamics, and that can lead to starvation. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come back with our newsmaker guest today, Barbara Fisher. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world and all of our syndicated program stations. Thank you for carrying us. We try to provide you with the program, the insights, the scholarship, the interest that empower people. Who was it? No one called in, so I'll share this with you. Who was it who told us that it is a negative virtue to have wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, business without ethics, science without humanity, religion without sacrifice, and politics without principle? It was Mahatma Gandhi. Let's go over and say hello now to Barbara Lo Fisher. I gave you her background a little earlier, president of the National Vaccine Information Center. They give a lot of information to consumers out there, and her blog is vaccineawakening.blogspot.com. And Barbara, what is the your latest book? Do you have a latest book?
Well, on our website at mbic.org, I published a booklet, which is referenced with more than 240 references, called Reforming Vaccine Policy and Law, A Guide. And what we're calling for is a reform of the mass vaccination system because we desperately need safety provisions in there, and we need informed consent protections. And people need to really get involved and work in their states to educate their legislators and get these reforms in place in the states so people can have vaccine choices.
Good. Well, here is my concern, and I'd like you to address it if you would, please. Here are the studies. This is the latest one just out today from Medical News Today. And it says, quote, despite most being fully vaccinated for whooping cough, the infection is still present in about a fifth of the children visiting their doctors with persistent cough. And whooping cough, also known as pertussis, is one of the most common diseases that can be prevented by vaccine. And, okay, so if it can be prevented by vaccine, and if they're vaccinated, then how can 20% of the full, quote, 20% of fully vaccinated children with persistent cough have whooping cough? Then they have a contradiction, and they're not dealing with it honestly. Added to that, a new report from Oxford University released yesterday on this topic, USA Today, medically conservative publication, had an article on whether or not pertussis is becoming resistant to the vaccine because of the high incidence of whooping cough cases among vaccinated kids. The FDA has also reported a growing rate of whooping cough cases among vaccinated population. And according to the CDC, quote, measles transmission has been clearly documented among vaccinated persons in large outbreaks. Over 95% of the cases have a history of vaccination, meaning 95% of the kids who came down with the measles have been vaccinated with their full complement. Well, then explain to me, because I am a scientist and a public health scientist, how in the world can you say that vaccines are safe and effective when clearly a lot of kids being vaccinated are not protected? And in fact, a New York State Department of Health, 2 of 20 people infected in a recent measles outbreak in New York City were children who had not been vaccinated, but 90% of those were vaccinated. You wouldn't know that from the news media. The Journal of the American Medical Association published data showing that antibody levels after rubella vaccination fell to half their high point within 4 years, and a study conducted by scientists from the Direct Health Clinic in South London found half of all children vaccinated with the MMR vaccine to have, quote, zero or very low immunity against measles and mumps. A quote, and this is from the study, this means there could be a lot of children who think they've got the umbrella protection yet remain at risk. But we're not telling anyone, once they've been vaccinated, that, well, there's a probability that if you could come down with this. Could you give us your insights on this, please?
Well, yes, we've been saying for a while now, and in fact have billboards up in the U.S. as well as on the CBS Jumbotron, a message that you need to know the risks and failures of vaccinations. Because a lot of people have been talking about risks, but very few have been talking about failures. And the truth is, as you pointed out in some of the information you just gave, with regard to, for example, the whooping cough vaccine, pertussis vaccine, there is not only waning immunity of people who have been vaccinated, but it looks as if you can in fact be vaccinated, still get whooping cough, be pertussis, whooping cough, not be symptomatic, and pass it on to others. This totally destroys the myth that there is vaccine acquired herd immunity in our population. They've known this for a while, and in fact the FDA put out a press release in November of 2013, a study that they had done in primates that showed, they looked at both, when they gave the primates both the whole cell DPT versus the acellular DTaP vaccine, you could have these primates who would actually be infected with whooping cough, be pertussis, but not show symptoms and then be able to pass it on to the other animals in their community. So it's a really interesting that, you know, we see all this coverage in the media. Everybody's got to get vaccinated. Just more and more vaccination will have us all be protected, when in fact that's not true.
I believe that we should start over. I believe this is a failed paradigm, and until we have independent, legitimate science where you have, let's say, 10,000 children fully vaccinated with the standard vaccines and meticulous medical records kept of them every 3 months, exams, blood levels, titers, antibody levels, and symptoms, and 10,000 children not vaccinated, but the same medical input, and then see what is the difference. Until such time we have those studies, and we don't, then we are guessing. Because I spent 2 years interviewing some of the leading immunologists in the world and toxicologists. And you never have your toxicologist brought into the discussion of vaccines safety issues, and they're excluded. And I've had toxicologists after toxicologists, top of their field, published in peer review, professors, and they say the fact that you could get an antibody response doesn't mean that it's a protective antibody response. We've had people who have little or no antibodies not get infected. People with lots of antibodies get infected. They have been projecting a mathematical model as if it were a certain scientific model. It isn't. And so I believe that we should start fresh, take the vaccine makers out of the equation and all the scientists they have for hire, and let true independent scientists work on the issue. Your final thoughts?
Well, I think that there's no question. There's huge gaps in the science. They really don't understand, for example, the influence of the microbiome, and we all have different, microbiota in our intestines, and we all have different profiles. They're not looking at epigenetics. I mean, these are two emerging fields in science that the vaccinologists don't even have a clue about. I think that certainly the new science is going to sweep away the old. I think you're right. It's a failed paradigm, and we're going to be seeing changes in this one-size-fits-all approach to how to maintain health. Measles, there was a study that was just published in February 2014, that they now have documented evidence that you can have two doses of measles vaccine and still get infected with and transmit measles to others who also have been vaccinated. So the science is going to come out, and then the policymakers are going to have to make a decision. And hopefully we're going to move away from this very narrow-minded view of how vaccines both create immunity and certainly don't create long-lasting immunity, if they do at all. So I agree with you. We're going to have to make changes.
We look forward to another conversation with you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Always diligent on behalf of the American consumer, Barbara Lowe Fisher down in Northern Virginia. She is with the National Vaccine Information Center. Lots of good information from there if you need any. vaccineawakening.blogspot.com. Now to the final segment of our program. I'm going to do this over the next 5 days. I'm sure many of you are confused about what is happening in Iraq and why, and with all the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on intelligence and spying and listening to every email, cell phone, phone call that we didn't know or reasonably expect. The blowback that has happened, especially since we were knowing that we were funding and training ISIS in Syria, also Turkey was, and Jordan, and that there wouldn't be these people like the Mujahideen after we trained and armed them in Afghanistan, became the Al-Qaeda. The current mainstream debate regarding the crisis in Iraq and Syria offers a near-perfect example of both the death of historical memory and the collapse of critical thinking in the United States. It also signifies the emergence of a profound anti-democratic culture of manufactured ignorance and social indifference. Now, surely, historical memory is under assault when the dominant media give airtime to the incessant warmongering of politicians such as Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham, and retro pundits such as Bill Kristol, Douglas Fife, Condoleezza Rice, and Paul Wolfowitz, not one of whom has any credibility given how they work to eliminate truth and legitimate the unremitting web of lies and deceit that provided cover for the disastrous invasion of Iraq under the Bush-Cheney administration. History repeats itself in the recent surges of calls for U.S. military intervention into Syria and Iraq. Such repetitions of history undoubtedly shift from tragedy to farce as former Vice President Dick Cheney once again becomes a leading pundit calling for military solutions to the current crisis in the Middle East, in spite of his established reputation for hypocrisy, lies, corporate cronyism, defending torture, and abysmal policymaking under the Bush administration. The resurrection of Dick Cheney, the Darth Vader of the 21st century, as a legitimate source on the current crisis in Syria and Iraq is a truly monumental display of historical amnesia and moral dissipation. It was Cheney who bears a large responsibility for the Iraq War, which was the single biggest foreign policy disaster that we've had since Vietnam, but even more costly. It will run as close to $6 trillion, 4,500 dead, over 50,000 injured, over 1 million suffering from either Gulf War syndrome or post-traumatic stress disorder. That's just on our side. Now think of the family members affected here, and think of what we did to the family members, innocent people, children, creating a death zone in Iraq. We did that. Missing from the commentaries by the mainstream media regarding the current situation in Iraq is any historical context that would offer critical account of the disorder plaguing the Middle East. A resurrection of historical memory in this moment could provide important lessons regarding the present crisis. What is clear in this case is that a widespread avoidance of the past has become not only a sign of the appalling lack of historical knowledge in contemporary American culture, but a deliberate political weapon used by the powerful to keep people passive and blind to the truth. Of course, there are factors currently contributing to this production of ignorance and the lobotomizing of individual and collective agency. Such factors extend from the idiocy of celebrity and popular culture and the dumbing down of American schools to the transformation of the mainstream media into a deadly mix of propaganda, violence, and entertainment. And the latter is particularly crucial as the collapse of journalistic standards that can inform the onslaught of information finds its counterpart in an unrelenting rise of political and civil illiteracy. The knowledge and value deficits that produce such detrimental forms of ignorance not only crush the imagination, critical modes of social interaction and political dissent, but also destroy those public spheres and spaces that promote thoughtfulness, thinking, critical dialogue, and serve as guardians of truth as facts. The blight of rampant consumerism, unregulated financial capital, and weakened communal bonds is directly related to the culture's production of autonomized, isolated, utterly privatized individuals who have lost sight of the fact that humanity is never acquired in solitude. This retreat into private silos has resulted in the inability of individuals to connect their personal suffering with larger public issues, thus detached from any concept of the common good or viable vestige of the public realm. They are left to face alone a world of increasing precarity and uncertainty in which it becomes difficult to imagine anything other than how to survive. Under such circumstances, there is little room for thinking critically and acting collectively in ways that are imaginative and courageous. Surely, the celebration and widespread prevalence of ignorance in American culture does not help anyone. We should not be acting so backward and so stupid, and yet we are. Yet, what is often missed in analysis of political and civic literacy as the new normal is the degree to which these forms of illiteracy not only result in an unconscious flight from politics, but also produce a moral coma that supports modern systems of terror and authoritarianism. Civic illiteracy is about more than the glorification and manufacture of ignorance on an individual scale. It is producing a nationwide crisis of agency, memory, and thinking itself. In conclusion for today, how else to explain, for instance, a major national newspaper's willingness to provide a platform for views that express an unchecked hatred of women, as when the Washington Post has published George Will's column in which he states that being a rape victim is now, quote, a coveted status that confers privileges. Will goes on to say that accusations of rape and sexual violence are not only overblown, but that many women who claim they were raped are delusional. There's a particular type of aggressive ignorance here that constitutes a symbolic assault on women, while obscuring the underlying conditions that legitimize sexual violence in the United States. Mr. Will expresses more concern over what he calls a pesky arithmetic used to determine the percentage of women actually raped on campuses than the ever-increasing incidence of sexual assault on women in colleges, the military, and a wide variety of private and public spheres. The clueless George Will, evidently angry about the growing number of women who are reporting the violence waged against them, draws on the persuasive utility of mathematical data as a way to bolster a shockingly misogynist argument and flee from any sense of social moral responsibility. While such expressions of resentment make Will appear as a fool, privileged white man who is truly delusional, he's in good company. He's got almost the entire Washington consensus with him. But he is typical of the expanding mass of pundits who live in a historical void and for whom emotional overtakes reason. Increasingly, it appears that the American media no longer requires that words bear any relationship to truth or to a larger purpose other than peddling rigid, archaic ideologies designed to shock and stupefy audiences. Clearly, the attack on reason, evidence, and science and critical thought has reached perilous proportions in this country. A number of political, economic, social, and technological forces now work to distort reality and keep people passive, unthinking, and unable to act in a critical engagement manner. Politicians, right and left-wing pundits, remember the left, the beautiful left, has 1% sociopaths who are the elite, and yet where is the courage to expose them? There is none, and they are just as mind-numbingly in contempt of anything decent and humane. Under such circumstances, literacy disappears, not just the practice of learning skills, but also as the foundation for taking informed action. Divorced from any sense of critical understanding and agency, the meaning of literacy is narrowed to competing basic reading, writing, and numeracy tasks assigned in schools. Literacy education is similarly reduced to strictly methodological considerations and standardized assessment rooted in test-taking and deadening forms of memorization and becomes far removed from forms of literacy that would impart an ability to raise questions about historical and social context. From Dr. Henry Giroux, Truth Out, more tomorrow. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Noll. Now let's go over and say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I want to let you know that your audience is listening. They're paying attention. And emails have been coming in as I'm sitting here. And we have someone that wrote in big, bold letters, underlined, 4 years ago, Gary spoke of what was going to happen in Iraq, and especially the fact that Muqtada al-Sadr is not going away. He's re-emerging as a major influence amongst the Shiites, and you called this 4 years ago. So people are responding as you are speaking.
What I said 4 years ago was that I predicted that within the near future, that the most powerful person in Iraq that would determine Iraq's entire future would be Muqtada al-Sadr and his army of about 100,000 people. But he was involved in a 7-year program in Iran at their holiest religious om, the city, where he was studying and going through his teachings to become a major religious leader in Iraq. He would be the second most powerful person in Iraq as the religious leader now. And when he returned, he would be influenced by and under substantial influence of Iran. And I saw that there could not be, once the U.S. had withdrawn, and based upon the corruption and cronyism of the current ruling elite, they were excluding all the Sunnis and excluding the Kurds, who had for a long time wanted their own territory. They had already been brutalized by Turkey, but the Kurds are in four different countries, including Syria. and Iraq and Iran and Turkey. And I said that the country will be divided up, and it will ultimately be a major war, a civil war, and then they'll each have their own area, with Baghdad being one of the places there would be a common use. But it would also ultimately be decided by all of the Arab nations in the area. And that's what I had said. And that looks like what is going to be happening. We're out of time. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing today?
Good.
Today we're going behind the lynching of the Central Park 7, Part 2. That's our subject today.
We look forward to it. Do you know what bothered me in particular, and I did a report on it at the time? All the major news media covered the story. But I got the report of how many African-American and Latino women were raped or mugged during the same period of time. And it was 29. And I thought, how unusual. They could have reported on 29 different people who were victimized, but chose not to report on any of them. Just this one.
Well, we're doing, for lack of a better term, a comparative analysis today. That's part of our discussion as well.
Great. We look forward to it. Utrice Lead right now.